Wow. Okay, here we go. First question today. I had heard this before. When you are aware, angry, you are no longer in the angry. Is this true? I actually mentioned that yesterday, that actually that's not true. That you are still angry. You're aware of anger, but you're still angry. So the thing is, awareness, that's a start. But you've got to do something about it as well. Learn how to let it go. Be kind. That's the same as remember the story of the guard and the rich woman's house. It was very aware. Burglars going in, burglars going in. Yeah, you were aware that the burglars were going in, but your house still got robbed. So you can be aware. Anger, 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 anger. But you're still angry. You get into trouble. So please, more than awareness. Awareness is only part of it. But of course you have to be aware, because somebody say, I'm not angry. I am not angry. And anyone says, I am angry, I will throttle you. So of course you have to be aware and be truthful. And the next one is to make sure that once there is a problem there, it needs to be fixed. If there's a fire, you've got to put it out. Dear Ajahn Brahm, is it possible to be a good businessman and at the same time a happy Buddhist in a capitalist society? Of course. If that wasn't possible, we'd be able to get no donations from you. So I encourage you, please be successful in your business. Now, of course it is. And there are many, actually, people who are really good business people and happy Buddhists as well. In a capitalist society, you know, sometimes we call it a capitalist society, but it really depends on your attitude to your business. And many people realize that business is important in life. You know, you've got to sort of start a business to employ people, to make funds so you can have taxes for hospitals and obviously donations, look after your family, send them to school, have enough food to eat. So of course you need to do that, but we have to do it in a good way. In other words, look, number one, just, you know, sometimes if you think that the bottom line is the money and that's the most important thing, you miss the most important part of being a business, is doing a service. And people have told me that, you know, if you do a service, if you're a really kind, good person, and you've got passion for what you're doing, the money will come, you know, anyway. But if you always focus on just getting money, and money, 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 that's the only thing, money, 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 you lose it all. That's why I was just getting this from somebody like that fellow from Google, Chade Meng, because I met him over in Singapore. Was it last year, this year, or sometime? Yeah, June. What that year is it? I live in the present moment. I don't know what year it is.
No. It's now. Year is
now. Now? Oh, that's right. Yes, thank you. I think it was last year sometime. Anyway, so at a conference over there, and you know, he was talking about, you know, how Google has become a successful company. You know, it's not just, they don't really think too much about the money. Now, that's the sort of, maybe the financial officers do, but what they really think about is just, you know, the innovation, the fun, to do things which are really cool and inventive. And, you know, they just have such passion for their work that, you know, the money just comes. And people actually say that if you employ someone, and if it's a really interesting job and a really sort of fulfilling work, you know, the money is secondary. They just love doing something which they can feel passionate about, make a difference, and just do something which is really cool and awesome for the world. And so that's the sort of business which is, you know, modern business models. So, and if obviously you're doing some service, something really good, something very useful, you're motivated, everybody else, you know, takes off on your motivation. It's inspirational, and just the money comes. And look, this place here, Jhana Grove, you know, this costs over $5 million. And where did all the money come from? Inspiration. That's what happened. You know, we said we're going to do this. Oh, come on. Too big. Everyone have their own ensuite, and people said, no, you won't be able to afford it. I said, yeah, let's do it. It's inspiring. And little by little, a bit here, a bit there, and all the money came just before we finished, so we had no debts. It's amazing. Amazing, building this with absolutely no debts. And this is actually what happens. It's just inspiration works. Dharmasala Nuns Monastery. We're doing, many of you have been over there, a big, how much is that? $3-4 million got a big project over there. And they just put the concrete slabs on. They've got all the buildings to do, the pipe work, the plumbing, the electrics. That's all done. Already enough money. Wow, that's incredible. Where did all that come from? I don't know. But just inspiration. Because people say, it's a really nice project. It's inspiring. When you do something inspiring in business, and this is the what I call the monk business. Not the monkey business, the monk business. So when you do something inspiring, people like to sort of chip in. And so I always think that's business as well. If you've got like an inspiring project, you're doing a really good service and a good thing, you know, the funds will come sooner or later. And also, when they do come, you feel really good about yourself. This is right livelihood. You're doing something good for the world, a really nice service. And that's what happens. So yeah, you can get good Buddhist business. And you know, you can be rich at the same time, and I know many people are like that. Really good Buddhists. They do business, and they just have a wonderful time. Look, they've got... Well, maybe they're not... Maybe should I say that one of the guys who left here, he's a lot of 2 days. Now, he's the CEO of this big business and builds apartment blocks. And I have to bless every site for his apartment blocks. Because every time he doesn't get me to bless his sites, you know, for the big apartment blocks in Perth, he always gets problems, always gets things wrong. True, absolutely. The first one is building this building site, this big apartment block, you know, not far from the river, I think it was Adelaide Terrace. And when they were excavating, they came across some bones, some indigenous bones. And of course that, you know, made them a bit sort of scared. They got indigenous elders in to do a cleansing ceremony. There's still problems. And they got some Christians in to do a ceremony. Still problems. They got me in to do the blessing. No more problems. True, absolutely true. And they thought, ah, you know, just coincidence, they thought. But then they had another place, and that was in Adelaide Terrace, flooding. And they got me to come in there, and after I did my bit, no more flooding. And that they really started making them to think. And then there's another place they had that's over in Beaufort Street somewhere, and they didn't, yeah, I don't bother, no, this is no problems over there. And their builder went bankrupt. They lost another, you know, a lot of money when they do this. So they invited me in there, no problems. So every time when I go there, there's no problems. You see, and that's why they're actually very generous. To Nudge Monastery projects, to our projects. So this is actually what happens. That's good business. So if you want a good business... Anyway... How do you combine detachment and devotion to your Ajahn or to the Buddha? Thank you. First of all, you know the three refuges? What are the three refuges? Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. Is Ajahn Brahmin there anywhere? Or Ajahn Shah or Ajahn anyone? It's to the Buddha, to the Dhamma and to the Sangha, which is monks and nuns. Not to one monk. So you don't take refuge in Ajahn Brahmin. You don't take refuge in Ajahn Chah or Ajahn anyone, or Guru or Rinpoche this, or Sayod or that. You take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha, remember? That's so important. So sometimes people say, oh, Ajahn Brahmin gives such good talks. Is it okay if I go to another retreat, you know, something like the Mahayana or the Tibetans? Is that okay? Or should I just go and not tell you? is it all right if I go and you know, listen to other teachers? Of course it's all right. As long as they're teaching Buddhism, then just go. As long as it's working, it's something useful, then go. Because what I really don't like when people say, you can only come to my retreat, and if you go to another retreat, that's it, you're blacklisted. You can't come ever again. And people sometimes do that, you know. And that is totally sort of un-Buddhist. The Buddha never said that. He didn't say, only come to listen to my talks, don't go to Sariputra's or Ananda's or any other person. No, just wherever you see Dhamma, go for it. So that is why that please don't bring this terrible sectarianism into Buddhism. And Mahayana, Tibetan teaching, Zen teachings, was a good teacher, male, female, whoever, go and listen. Because you are going there to listen not to the teacher, who are listening to the Dhamma. And you always take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. We call that the Ti Sarana. So I say, I take refuge. Sarana means refuge. The Ti Sarana, I take refuge in tea. I drink a lot of it. No, it's Ti Sarana, Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. So that's why you are devoted to the Dhamma, but the teacher, that's just the vehicle. Dear Ajahn Brahm, how can one open the door of one's heart? You go to a cardiac surgeon, and he will incise you here. Yeah, that's absolutely true, that my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, I think it was in Adelaide, someone was looking for it in a bookshop, and they found it in the medical section. They did. That was really cute. They actually, I'm not a joke, they actually found it there. Someone put it in the, open the door of your heart, they thought it was how to do heart surgery. How can one open the door of one's heart to the fact that current 402 ppm CO2 in our atmosphere and the catastrophic consequences of that, where most of the world, including Buddhists, are in denial that we are headed for climate-induced disaster? Change with deepest respect. Okay. Instead of getting afraid about it, do something about it. Now, what can you do as a Buddhist? How much carbon dioxide comes out of your mouth? So if you calm down, become peaceful, and do more meditation, your metabolism goes down, less carbon dioxide comes out. And look, quite significant amounts of carbon dioxide get reduced when you meditate instead of rushing all about. So if every human being in this world meditated for 1 hour a day, that would reduce carbon emissions enormously. Number two, we need carbon sinks. You know, we have to capture the carbon in our world. And so if you eat lots of carbohydrates like I do, I capture it in my tummy. So that's what you need to do. Capture more carbon by eating more carbohydrates and capturing it in here. And if everybody, all the 7 billion people in the world, captured so much carbon as I'm capturing, then of course there would be so much. At least if I'm going to die with climate change, I'm going to die happy. If you can, do something about it. And try and reduce. One of the nicest things about Buddhists, we know we really try hard to live simply. They have few possessions. Living in a small house. Small vehicle, you know, Hinayana is the best, small vehicles. You don't need big vehicles. Have less kids, you know, be celibate. That saves a lot of problems with, you know, overpopulation in this world. You know, and just, you know, eat one meal a day. Then you don't need so many farmers just, you know, working their butts off. So, whatever you do, the simplicity of Buddhism, where we don't look at possessions as a be-all and end-all in life. We don't need big things. And that's an important message from the very beginning. Simplicity, having few possessions. Now, that's always been a very wonderful part of Buddhism. And it's a great thing for our modern world. So live simple, like the monks and nuns. Could you give advice on the role of visualization and imagining one is an arahat for helping stillness? That'd be nice, isn't it? Imagine you're an arahat, fully enlightened. Then you don't have to worry about going for lunch. Can you do that? That's a test if you can really imagine you're an arahat. Arahat, no desires, no desires at all. So you imagine that, and then when it gets to 11 o'clock, I'm an arahat, no desires, no desires. No desires, no desires, no desires. You get up there and you eat anyway. So the nice thing about visualization, visualize something useful. So an imagination. Now, this is a little meditation technique. I haven't taught you yet, but it's actually very good. And you can actually include this in your repertoire of meditation tricks. Sitting down, get yourself nice and comfortable, close your eyes, and then imagine the most peaceful time you've ever had in your life. Remember it. So it goes into the past, yeah. But remember the most peaceful, blissful experience you've ever had. It may be like a deep meditation. It may be just, You know, you're off into some nice holiday destination or up in the mountains, by a beach or whatever, and you felt so content and happy. You know, when you didn't want anything else in the whole world, just to be there with the people you were with and the time. You've all had times like that. So imagine one of them. And once you start to imagine it, start to reinforce it, start to remember as many details as you can. You know, was it the morning, the afternoon, the evening? Was it summertime or wintertime or spring or autumn? You know, exactly what time of the year was it? Who was with you? You know, were there trees around? What type of trees? Were they green? Were there yellow leaves on the trees? You know, were there buildings around? What were the buildings? Were they old? You know, who else was with you? Were you sitting down, laying down? What clothes did you have on? Because every time you add a detail, you are reinforcing that memory. And you go on like that for at least 5 minutes, reinforcing the memory of the most peaceful, calm, content time you've ever had. For about 5 minutes. And every time the longer you stay there with that feeling, the more the important ingredient of peace is established in you. And after 5 minutes, you let go of the memory, you forget about it. But what you will find remains with you is the peace. That's what, at least a large amount of it remains. And then you go, say, watching your breath, and you're just so peaceful already. You're way ahead of the game. Simply because, you know, you've actually done some work. Yeah, this is work, this is control, this is doing something, but it's doing something quite useful. Recording the most peaceful moment you've ever had in your life for about 5 minutes, and then when you let the memory go and you relax, what's left is the peace. And then you just go very deep, very quickly. That's a wonderful way of visualization. You know, when I was, years and years and years ago, I used to teach the kiddies. You know, in the Dharma school, when I first came to Perth, and there's some of the kiddies, you know, I taught, and now they're, you know, big people with their own children. But I always remember the little Dharma class I used to teach, there's only about 8 or 9 of them. And how can you teach, like, you know, 7 or 8, 9-year-olds meditation? And I didn't have any resources, so I just investigated and experimented, and I developed this type of meditation. And, you know, when I'm saying this, you can try it yourself. It's really wonderful. Now you sit down, these little 7 or 8-year-olds, sit yourself down nice and comfortable. And now imagine that you are flying out of your body, up over the rooftops of Perth, out over to the beach, because kids over in Australia, they love the beach and the sea. Out over the beach, just over the waves, way away from the land into the ocean, to your special place in the ocean. And you fall into that ocean and you float. You'd have no pressure on you at all. And it's warm water and so cool and quiet. You look around, you can't see any ship, any boat anywhere. You look up at the beautiful blue sky, there's a nice soft wind blowing over you. And you're just floating there, nothing to do in the whole world, in your special place in the ocean. I go like this for about 5 or 10 minutes. And they really get into it. And then, were you getting into it? I was actually getting into it when I was saying it. And then after 5 or 10 minutes, then now's the time to come out again. So imagine just floating up out of the water, just over the ocean. You can see the beaches of Perth, and you come over the beaches. No, much lower than this. And into this little temple, and you come back into your body, and you're just so relaxed and peaceful. Now open your eyes. And that's what the way I taught them every week. And now these people in their 30s and 40s, no, 30s I think. No, 40s, they must be in their 40s now. 35, no, late 30s. And they still do that. I said, do you meditate? Yeah, we do that same meditation. We just really got used to it. And it's these 30-year-old people, you know, floating up over the oceans into their nice warm place in the ocean where they used to go as a kid. So those are like visualizations. If you get into it, you can actually, you know, do a lot, and it makes it very peaceful and very wonderful. Imagining, that's also very helpful. There's this one fellow, you know, he could never watch his breath. And, always, you know what it's like, these are the days when people told you, watch the breath at the tip of the nose. And he just found it so difficult. And he never told me who said this, but, whoever said this, they really had a good idea and they knew how to meditate, this teacher. Always wondered who it was. But this teacher told this guy, you're having trouble watching your breath? Yeah, that's quite sort of common. Okay, just close your eyes. And now just imagine you're watching your breath. Just imagine it, okay? Don't do it, just imagine it. So, okay, close your eyes and imagine you're watching your breath going in, breath going out. Imagine you're watching it going in, going out. And after about 3 minutes, the teacher said, what are you watching? And he had to admit, he's watching his breath. The thing was, he never tried to watch his breath. When he tried to watch his breath, he couldn't do it. So just imagine you're watching your breath. If you imagine that for 3 minutes, you find you are actually watching your breath. That's the power of imagination. Imagination and truth is just so close together. It's easy to take an imagination and make it real, especially with just something like watching the breath. And you can do that with being peaceful. Okay, you haven't been peaceful. Haven't had a good meditation all week. Okay, just imagine what it must be like to have a good meditation. Just close your eyes and imagine that you are Ajahn Brahm, just meditating here. A nice smile on your face. Imagine your belly going out a bit and saying nice and fat, like Ajahn Brahm, nice and happy. Imagine Ajahn Brahm meditating here, just watching your breath, seeing all the incredible nimittas, and oh, it's just really nice. And then you find you're doing it as well. It actually works. So experiment and try it. Then you find it's actually quite powerful. So that's my thing about visualization and imagining. Dear Ajahn, could you please talk a little bit about right effort or the right Eightfold Path? No, I'm too lazy to talk about right effort. What's the next question? Right effort is the effort to stop, to say no, to renounce, to let go. It's the effort to make peace. Be kind and be gentle. That is the effort. Because people think, well, you've got to do something, but it's the stopping the doing. That's the effort. It's not easy to go against the stream of craving, to do something which is not your habitual way of doing things. And that is where we need the effort. But don't confuse the effort of just more doing stuff, more controlling, more making things happen. It is the effort of the donkey to stop and let the carrot go away, and then the carrot comes into the donkey's mouth. That is the effort. You know that the word for energy or effort was virya. And when I started learning Pali, I noticed that that word comes from another word, Pali word, called vira, which is the hero. And that was actually used for the leader of the Jains, was called Mahavira, the great hero. And those two, the energy and the hero, the right effort and the energy, so the right effort and the hero, are very close together. That's why sometimes I call it heroic effort. And in the context of early Buddhism, who was a hero? This was, a very early culture. The hero was the person who was a soldier, who went into battle and sacrificed their life for the king. That was just the culture in those days. That was a hero. One who would let go of their body and concerns for themselves would be so selfless. That was the hero. And that was what effort is. It's the heroic effort, the selfless effort, to abandon and let go of everything. Just like this hero in the war would let go of their life for the cause, keeping nothing back for themselves. Now that gives you an idea what right effort is. But if you really have the confused idea that right effort means I'm going to go for it, only a couple of days left. Oh, I'm not going to sleep. I'm going to meditate all night tonight. Tonight's my night. Yeah, I can sleep when I'm in my coffin. I'm going to meditate now or bust. And I had that experience once. Many other people who are stupid like me did this. I was only, I must have been 18. I went to my first WASAC when I was at Cambridge University. And this monk, I think it was actually Dr. Sadatissa, you know, this old monk who was in London at the time, he gave this inspiring talk about the life of the Buddha. And part of the story was the Buddha decided to sit under the Bodhi tree. And he made this resolution. Even though my bones dry up, now my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up, I will not move from this seat until I get full enlightenment or die trying. And from an 18-year-old male, I thought, wow, that is the way to get enlightened. Now, I'd only just started meditating. I could do 20 minutes. That's all. But that afternoon, I went back to my room and I got out my meditation cushion. And with as much sincerity as an 18-year-old could do, I sat down and said, right, if the Buddha could do it, so can I. Even though my bones turn to dust, even though my blood dries up, I am not going to move from this cushion until I get enlightened. Now, I had lots to do in my life. I've got this out, get enlightenment out of the way, then I can go out with my girlfriend. That's what I thought. So, okay. And I sat there. You know, I actually made 40 minutes. I never sat that long in my life. And it hurt like hell. But after 40 minutes, I couldn't stand it. I could not stand it any longer. And I opened my eyes, and I was really disappointed. My blood hadn't dried up. My bones were still intact, and I wasn't enlightened. Has any of you ever done things like that? It's absolutely ridiculous and stupid. Total ego. Because that's where that type of effort comes from, an ego. And really, that type of effort just makes a bigger ego. So that is not the right effort. The right effort, as opposed to the wrong effort, is the effort to stop, to let go, to sacrifice, to renounce, to say no. That is the right effort. Every time I attended the retreat, cannot remember how many times, but don't blame yourself if on this retreat you've been coming many, many times and you still haven't gotten anywhere. It's your teacher's fault. If I was a good teacher, you'd be enlightened straight away. But some of you keep coming back year after year after year. If I was a teacher at school, what would happen if everyone came back grade one, they come back again, grade one, come back again, grade one? I'd lose my job. I don't know why I keep my job, actually. So anyway, that's my job as a teacher. A teacher's main aim in life is to get rid of their disciples. That's what I'm trying to get rid of you. And that is absolutely true. Come on, become enlightened and get out of here. So I can have a nice, easy life. So a teacher's job, their aim is not to get more disciples. Not to get more followers, but to get rid of followers, to enlighten people, to teach them so they don't need you anymore. And I'm a terrible teacher. I keep getting more disciples. And the old ones keep coming back. I try to get rid of you by saying the same joke over and over again. And you still come back for more. I can't understand it. Anyway, every time I attended the retreat, cannot remember how many times, I started to enjoy many things that were taken for granted, i.e. stars and trees and animals and insects, etc. And amazingly, I can even enjoy my wife nagging. Oh, isn't that nice? It's very true because, you know, sometimes we get used to things. You know, the wife nagging, sometimes that, you know, we actually miss it when she's gone. That's why there's a few people, these were, you know, and this is Western Australia, in Perth, they have these mines up in the north of Western Australia. And people go in, they call fly in, fly out. They go up there for maybe 2 weeks at a time sometimes. And they come to me and said, yeah, you know, I have to go up to the north, you know, to get enough money. It's, you know, it's good wages up there, but I really miss my wife. Can you help me, Ajahn Brahm? You know, because I'm a bit homesick when I go up there. So very easy. And I asked them to get what I called a nagging tape. So, you know, record your wife when she's nagging you. And then take it up with you up to the mines. And whenever you miss your wife, turn on the nagging tape. And then you won't feel you're missing her anymore. And the same, you can do the same, you know, if you're a wife and you miss your husband. Just, you know, get a tape of him saying, "Oh, I'll do it later, darling. Oh, I'm busy now." Then you won't miss him anymore. Crikey, I'm glad I'm away from that. And amazing, I can even enjoy my wife nagging. Well done. But very soon I am back to the cranky old man again. What should I do? Sleep on floor, no food after 12 minutes, etc. Please help. Okay, so you're enjoying yourself now. But you find when you leave here, if you do leave here, because there's still a lot of time to go and the future is uncertain, that if you do leave here, you may be, you know, back to the cranky old man you were before, but not as cranky. You always get a little bit less. And your wife or husband sees that. The old story, this man in the early days in Perth, we used to do just weekend retreats. And this man told his wife, "I want to go on a weekend retreat with Noah's Ajahn Chakra." And his wife said, "No, it's too busy on the weekend. All the stuff we have to do. No, you can't go." So he was a very good husband. He said, "Okay, darling, I'll help you this weekend. Next time a weekend retreat, can I come on a weekend retreat?" "Of course you can't go. We've got to take the kids to sport. You know, you've got to clean the gutters. I've got to do the shopping and you've got to fix up the garden. Of course you can't go. There's too much to do. Next retreat, can I go to the retreat, darling?" "No, the mother's visiting and we've got to sort of fix up the stuff for this and that." And every time it was the same answer from the wife. You know, there's too much stuff to do. But at least he was persistent. That's the trick, guys, okay? Persistence. And then he said once, "Can I go on a weekend retreat, darling?" And she said, "You go on your weekend retreat and leave me with the kids and the shopping and the housework and everything else. You go off and be selfish." So he went. But it's permission. But has much permission. But what happened next? He went off on a retreat. And he told us this afterwards. He said, when he got back home after the retreat, he was such a soft and beautiful husband. The wife could see the change and she appreciated it so much that when it came time, absolutely true, when it came down to the next retreat, he never needed to ask. She gave him the money and said, "Off you go." Because your loved ones, they see the change in you. And you're far less of a pain in the ass to your husband or your wife after you've been on a retreat for a while. And they appreciate that. So that's why they say, "Oh yeah, retreat, go, go, go." So that sometimes there is a big change in you. Okay, after a while, you know, a lot of it just disappears, which means you try and get on the retreat again, once it starts to get less. Or you try and do more meditation at home. But it does have a huge effect on you. Now, you may not notice that because you haven't seen the change and everyone else is changing at roughly the same rate. When you go home, even those of you who think, "Oh, I've had a terrible retreat, I've got nowhere, no nimittas, no jhanas, nothing there." When you go home, the people you live with will see a huge change in you. And you realize, wow, something has happened. And they will notice it. And you'll be quite amazed. But you say, "No, I've changed." Yeah, you're amazing. You're so peaceful, so kind. Sometimes we can't see it ourselves, but other people can appreciate it. So you do change. Every one of you, even the worst meditator in this room, you've made a lot of progress. And your people you live with will see that. Dear Ajahn, should the Eightfold Path be followed in the same order as they appear in the teachings? Please clarify. Thanks. No, shuffle them up. You know, like shuffle up cards and you put it this way and that way and a bit of this and a bit of that. So you don't have to do them in order. Because sometimes a bit of this and a bit of that. Because that's what I did. You know, I started with my meditation. You know, that's where I started my Buddhism. I had no idea about precepts. You know, but little by little, because I was meditating, I started to realize that, you know, that I got sensitive. So this was late in London, okay, so you go on the buses. And if the conductor never asked for the fare, I thought I didn't need to pay him. And so I'd walk off without paying. They never asked. Okay, no ask, no pay. And then afterwards, when I started thinking about that, that's really unfair. Now someone has to pay the bus driver and pay for the gas and other maintenance of the bus. So I thought, okay, no, I'm going to actually pay every time now, even if they don't ask me. And I started doing that. And I felt so much more happiness. You know, I was taking alcohol. And I thought, after a while, what is this stupid taking out? What am I doing this for? And I was going to parties. You know, and parties, I found a nice girl, went in the corner with her. And when I was taking alcohol, I could never remember that time. But when I didn't take alcohol, the best time of a party, I was totally aware and enjoyed every moment of it. And I thought, why am I getting drunk for? It's stupid. So and I stopped alcohol. I stopped so many things when I was a student. And I didn't do that because, you know, I was told about the five precepts. And what happened? I went to a Thai temple in London. I was going there quite regularly to meditate. And one day the Thai monk took me aside and said, you've been coming here long enough. It's about time you took the five precepts. And I said, what are the five precepts? He said, no, not killing a living being. I was a vegetarian then. So I'm a vegetarian. I don't even eat meat at that time. And he said, we're not sort of stealing. He said, no, I pay all of my fares, everything, totally. If they don't ask, I give it to them. Not committing adultery. I've only got one girlfriend. One girlfriend's enough. I can't afford another one. I'm only a student. Lying. I said, no, I decided to tell the truth. I always tell the truth. And no alcohol. Yeah, I gave that up. And I told the monk, I was cheeky and arrogant, but I said, you know, Venerable Sir, I don't need to take the five precepts. I'm already keeping them. Bye-bye. But that was actually a true story. I learned the five precepts just because of meditation. So, you know, my virtue came second. My wisdom and meditation came first, and I got the other factors afterwards. So, you know, people do it in really weird ways. Some people start with the precepts, and they learn meditation afterwards, they learn a bit of wisdom. You can start from all parts and just jumble up the Eightfold Path, as long as eventually they all come together. So you don't need to do it in one particular way. Dear Ajahn Brahm, may I suggest three sadhus to you and Bianca, Dania and Mike for providing us with this 5-star retreat. Only three sadhus for 5 stars? Should be 5 sadhus. For 5 stars. If you think it's a 6-star retreat, 6 stars. But that was earlier, not now. So that comes in the end. Dear Ajahn, why do some people want to go through past life regressions? Why not let the past be the past and be contented with the present life? The only reason people like going through past life regressions is so many people these days just have a very strong belief that there is no such thing as rebirth. It's not like they've got an open mind and think, maybe there is, maybe there's not, I haven't actually got the evidence yet, and keep that open mind. They live life as if this is the only life. And it's so hard, there's so much evidence. I was a theoretical physicist, I know the rules of evidence. The evidence is there, it's so convincing. I remember seeing this professor of philosophy, you know, I think in some big university in the United States, and he went on YouTube, he said, look, I've read the work of Professor Ian Stevenson, you know, who did some of the best watertight, rigorous research on past lives. And he said, look, I'm a philosopher. I'm not religious in any which way. But if you follow the rules of evidence, as I've been taught in philosophy, you have to admit, you've got no other choice, that reincarnation has been proved. I remember him saying that. The point is that what they say in science these days, extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. In other words, they change the goalposts. If you don't want to believe it, and they call it extraordinary, then the level of proof is just impossible. And that's really, really, it's quite, it's got no intellectual integrity to it. It's just like dogma. I don't want to believe it, therefore, you know, the level of proof is just impossible. And if you use the ordinary levels of proof for anything else, And then reincarnation is so obvious that the evidence is strong, it passes all of the requirements. So that's one of the reasons why I encourage people to remember their past lives. The more people who have those experiences, then the more it will get in people's brains, in our culture, that reincarnation, rebirth, is a fact. And I say to people, if you don't believe reincarnation, don't worry, because you certainly will believe in reincarnation in your next life. That's a little joke. Dear Ajahn, BBC reported on a few occasions that there is a yogi in the Himalayas who is over 1,000 years old. Are you sure it was 1,000 years and not 1,000 months, like I keep saying? Also, there was another yogi who does not eat. He was shown in Indian TV. With deep jhanas, can one reach these extreme conditions, or do these yogis have different mental powers? Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what you can do through meditation, and there are some of these yogis, and people do these documentaries. Obviously, you've got to make sure that it's a real documentary and not just, you know, some magician. But no, magicians, no, they can, what is it, like David Copperfield making bones disappear and flying through the air. That's just, you know, messing around with special effects, you know, on TV. But real, sort of, these real yogis, you've got to really check to make sure it's real. So you do need to have some people like the BBC who've got a reputation that, you know, if they fake it, they're going to lose that reputation and they're going to suffer immensely. And so sometimes these BBC documentaries, you know, are believable, they're credible. And you see some of the people they meet, and they do all these experiments with them. What is it? Somebody, one of the monks said they buried one of these yogis, you know, for about 60 days or something, you know, deep in the ground. No food, no water, I think no air either. And they had sort of ECGs and other stuff on him. And as soon as, you know, he was buried, after a few minutes, everything went flat, flat line. And then when they pulled him up after, just before 60 days, then it started working again. It started, the heart and the lungs started working again. And, you know, it was, you know, he told himself, you know, when he's going to come out of this deep meditation state, and he did. And that was all done on BBC, you know, in clinical, rigorous conditions. So, you know, there's amazing things happen. And if you get into even a little deep meditation, you can get some idea of how these things actually work. They do work. And I'd like to tell the story. I don't know who this monk was. He apparently is a Vietnamese monk. Ajahn Sujata knows him. He was teaching a retreat over in the east of Australia. And now, just like the retreats we do here, 9 days. So first of all, the first evening, Friday evening I think it was, you know, he meditated, everybody meditated for half an hour, and then after half an hour he would give the introductory talk. But when it was time to give the introductory talk, he was still meditating. And he carried on meditating. People were waiting for him to open his eyes and ring the bell and give the talk. 9, 10 o'clock, you know, he hadn't opened his eyes, so everyone left and they went to bed. And when they got up in the morning, he was still sitting there, you know, no chanting, no talk. And he sat like that for about 8 days. He didn't move. No toilet, no water, no drink, no food, nothing. He just sat there. And you know, they just, you know, like you, just carry on meditating, doing whatever you think you want to do. And then only after 8 days, you know, he came out of his meditation. The first thing he did was to apologize. I'm terribly sorry, I should have been giving you some talks. And everybody said, no, that's one of the most amazing things we've ever seen. We're so inspired. You've done 8 days without moving, without drinking any water, eating, going to the toilet, nothing. That was incredible. Well done. But, you know, don't say his name because, you know, you don't want to make people famous. But, you know, that actually happened in Australia recently. So these things do occur. So how they occur? First of all, we know they do. And they get so still and so peaceful in meditation, you don't need anything. So, yeah. Dear Ajahn, do arahats have preferences, e.g. types of food, drinks and colours? Do they have preferences on sensual pleasures and why? There was this one time that there was one of these monsters decided to test the Buddha. And this monster was called Suchiloma. which meant needle hair. So out of his body with his really sharp hairs, he was the first punk in history, with all his sharp hair coming out. And so he saw the Buddha and he said, now is this a real enlightened being or not? So he sat next to him. There was a Buddha and this sharp, needle-haired monster sitting next to him. And then the monster leant towards the Buddha, you know, basically to hurt him. And the Buddha leant away. And the yakka said, you're not enlightened, you're afraid of pain. You know, you have preferences. And the Buddha said, now listen, even though you're enlightened, you have loving kindness and care to your own body. You know, you don't deliberately go and search for a snake to bite your toe, or you don't jump into a fire. You know, these are things which, of course, you will avoid out of kindness to your body, to keep it healthy, so you can teach people. So sometimes, you know, and he taught the yakka that, you know, you were just misunderstanding what an enlightened person is. Of course an enlightened person will eat the food which will make them healthy, so that they can avoid discomfort and teach the Dhamma. They will exercise just enough to keep them healthy so they can have a long life. Yeah, they will have preferences. Even an enlightened being will have a preference to do their business, to urinate and defecate in the toilet rather than right here. But, because I thought about that, I said, when you're enlightened, you have no desires. I thought, no desires, so, no, urinating here or urinating in the toilet is all the same. No desires, no preferences. And of course, that's ridiculous. Even the Buddha went to the toilet to do his business. He didn't do it right in the middle of the monastery. So there are preferences, and it's like common sense, but why? And the thing I mentioned to you was like certainly food. It's like out of kindness to your body. Out of compassion. Because even though the emotions of greed, hate and delusion disappear from the enlightened being, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, those are the emotions left. That's what motivates and keeps the enlightened being going until they pass away. Out of compassion is what motivates them. Dear Ajahn, please explain why Buddhism does not believe in creator God or soul. Many thanks and regards. It doesn't believe in it because there ain't one. But this is, I mentioned this early on. A creator God. What does that mean? It means that, you know, they think everything has to have a creator. So they say a creator God was a creator. And then even schoolboys, like when I was a schoolboy, asked the same question. Well, everything has to be created, and God created everything. Who created God? And then it just goes back again. You know, who created the creator who created God? And it's unsatisfactory, philosophically. It's not logical. And so that has, you know, been a question which no one has been able to answer satisfactorily. Even, I think it was Saint Augustine said, it is illogical, that's why we believe. In other words, you can't know it, so you just have to take it on trust, we have to believe. Saint Augustine was one of the great intellectuals of Christianity, you know, 4th century or 5th century or whatever. Now he was also the one, he said, look, God cannot be kind and powerful. He said, because, a very simple argument, if this was 4th, 5th century Christian, if God is all-powerful, in other words, omnipotent, then why the heck doesn't he do anything about suffering? Because people suffer. If he's got the power, why doesn't he use it? He said, well, it must be because he's not kind. He can't be all-powerful and kind. If he's all-kind, then he can't be all-powerful. Because if he was all kind and all powerful, he'd be able to stop suffering. So he said, because suffering exists in this world, God cannot be all powerful and all kind. He could be all powerful but not kind. He could be all kind and not powerful. But he cannot be all powerful and all kind. Otherwise there would be no suffering. is a great argument from a great Christian. So anyhow, when they say the Creator God, you know, you simple arguments, even kids can understand. If you have a Creator God, who created the Creator God? And you know, what did he actually create? And when it comes to universes, now you watch even documentaries by modern theoretical physicists. Big Bang is not the only Big Bang there has been. Many, many, many Big Bangs. Serial universes. So which one did God create? Was a different God for every universe? And this is one of the things that we say, if it can happen once in physics, it can happen again. If you can create one Higgs particle, you can create another one. So if there's one universe, why not two, three, four, five? If you're born once, why not twice, three, four, five, six times? Reincarnation. Things go round and round. Things don't happen just once in this world. It actually keeps on repeating itself. The whole of life, the sun going round, or like the earth going round the sun, days and nights, you know, fashions. These things always keep repeating themselves. That's why I keep telling the same stories and same jokes. This is part of reincarnation, rebirth, one universe after another. It always repeats itself. So when you say like many universes, the idea of a creator God makes no sense at all. Which universe did he create? And there was no first universe. And that's also why I mentioned early on, remember I gave that simile of time? Space having no edges to it, but being a finite area, it doesn't have a beginning or an end, space. So why should time have a beginning and an end? Why? It's just the way we just perceive is just too limited. We think time must have a beginning and must have an end. Once we think that, we have to have some sort of creation, some origination of things. And that causes so many problems. And the answer is, why does time have to have a beginning? It can be just like space, without any boundaries, but finite. Da-da-da. Now that's Buddha. Buddhism has always been incredibly profound. It's been deep, but you can give answers to it and you start to get some handle on this. And it solves all so many problems. Anyway, Venerable Sir, one has to exhaust karmic energy in this life and future lives. If one decides to commit suicide, would such an action cause bad karma if the person has good reasons such as terminal illness and no desire to prolong the life? There is karmic energy, but remember that just what the last one thing you do at the end of your life will not decide everything. You know, it's the whole of your life. Now, I said that thing with an examination. You know, just one bad question, the last question you answer, that will not affect you that badly. It won't stop you going to university if every other question was correct. So this idea of suicide, you know, sometimes it's bad enough that a person commits suicide. And when people come along, whether it's Christians or Buddhists or Muslims, say, that's a terrible thing, you're going to go to hell. Imagine what that does to parents and friends. And to me, that is just really gross. You know, it's bad enough, you know, losing your son or your daughter who committed suicide. And these JoJos of priests come along and say, and your son's going to go to hell for that. He's going to burn. He's going to be tortured. Terrible things are going to happen to him for eons because he committed suicide. Poor mother. That's disgusting what people do. And it's also incorrect. Karma doesn't work like that. If you're a Christian, wouldn't sort of God forgive you? Say, oh, no, that's a big mistake, but never mind. The door of my heart is open to you, even though you committed suicide. Come inside. I sometimes had that. I mentioned that in interfaith groups. Now, if there was a God, and I say, if the worst person in the world, and I say just Adolf Hitler for one of somebody else, he wasn't that bad. He was a vegetarian, he loved his mother. Even though all bad. Even like, remember Pauline Hanson? Pauline Hanson is the racist politician in Australia. No, she had a fish and chip shop, and as soon as I heard that, anyone who had a fish and chip shop, can't be all bad. That's common. So I said, okay, so Adolf Hitler dies, and he goes up to God, because Adolf Hitler was supposed to, he's a Christian, he was a Catholic. So Adolf Hitler goes and meets God. What would God do? And God would say, Adolf, you've been a bad boy. You killed so many people, badly. But Adolf, the door of my heart is always open to you, to everybody, no matter what you've done. If a monk like me can open the door of the heart, can't God? And God would give Adolf this big hug, just like you hug the teddy bear. Never mind. And little Adolf, all that reason why he did terrible things to people, the cause of that would just totally vanish. When he realizes he receives unconditional love, he will cry his eyes out. I say, God will tell him, look, there's people in here who just don't understand. So if you don't mind, we'll shave off that silly moustache, you know, give you a new hairstyle, so people won't recognize you, and then you can come inside and live with us. Do you think any God, compassion, would send anybody to hell? Never made any sense to me. If God is love, anybody, everyone can come in. That's what I think anyway. So, suicide is not such a bad thing. Dear Ajahn Brahm, but please don't do it, at least not on this retreat. Otherwise I get into big blame. Dear Ajahn Brahm, burn holy paper for our parents that just passed away or already passed away. Is it useful for them? How much smoke is there already in China? There's enough pollution there already, and if you're going to go and burn incense, they're just going to make more smoke. Absolutely not. If you want to help your parents and not kill more people with pollution, then don't go around burning sort of paper this and paper that. Instead, and this is Malaysia, that, you know, there's a great organization there, the Malaysian Buddhist Cooperative. You know, their whole reason to exist, the first reason to exist, is to try and teach people the Buddhist way to do funerals and stop all this nonsense. If you want to make some good karma for your parents, they print Buddhist books for free and distribute them. And they got me, because I was well known in Malaysia, me and Dr. Kesri Dhammananda, you know, to write forwards. So we give this organization some cred. So people would read that and think, oh, no, chief priest, Dr. Kesri Dhammananda says we don't have to do this. Ajahn Brahm says we don't have to do this. All these other monks, Venerable Saranankara says we don't have to do this. And they start to believe that, which means they don't waste all this money. You know, have you ever seen the hell money and the heaven money? They burn both just in case. Yeah, exactly. I mean, what are you doing that for? If you're going to go to hell, that's not going to help you. So that is old culture. But just because it's old culture doesn't mean it's right. Because I remember talking to an indigenous elder, an Aboriginal, who, you know, we're talking about some of the ancient cultures of the indigenous people, such as, you know, their punishment for people who misbehave was spearing them, which is brutal. And you know, I asked him, he said, yeah, this is very thousands of years old culture, but does that mean you can't change it? And he looked at me and said, of course we can change it, if there's a reason to. You know, and that's in Australia, where the indigenous people hold on to their culture very, very strongly. Yes, you can change it. And one of the indigenous elders here in Perth, you know, that was Dennis Eggington. You know, he's quite well known. He's head of the Aboriginal Legal Service here in Perth. You know, he told me a story. He said that there was, here in Perth, there was a couple of Aboriginal kids, indigenous kids, you know, university, and they were driving back after university to their house, and they got hit by a car. driven by drunken kids. And the two indigenous kids were killed. And the drivers of the other car were arrested by the police. Now this was a rare incident because the drunken kids were also indigenous. And so when they had the funeral service, you know, for the two kids who were killed, the drivers, actually they were in prison. But the parents of the drivers were at the funeral service. So were the police, in force, because they expected payback. The indigenous Australian culture, if you hurt me, I've got to hurt you back physically. And if I can't do it, if I can't hurt you, I've got to hurt your parents. So they expected payback. And so the police were trying to stop that. And in the middle of the service, the father of one of the kids who was killed jumped up, got past the police, and went for the father of the kid who killed his son. Everyone expected payback, but this father instead just hugged his son's killer, just saying, "I forgive." And this indigenous elder in Perth, Dennis Egerton, said that was totally against the indigenous culture. But everyone was so happy that he did it. And even though he was young, he became an elder in the community, in the Noongar community in Perth. Because everyone recognized that what a wonderful thing it was to go against the culture and do something which would create more peace and harmony in the community. And yeah, this is probably the leading indigenous elder in Perth told me this story. Culture can be changed. Now, if it's worthwhile doing it. So Chinese culture, yes, it's important to remember it. But if it's something which is not helpful, it has to be changed. Burning paper houses, paper computers, paper Mercedes Benz. It's obvious that's something which can be changed. Do you believe that someone can cast the evil eye on you? Absolutely not. If they cast the evil eye on me, I'll cast it back. 2 times more powerful. That happened almost once. I was visiting my mother in London, in her apartment, and, you know, spending some time with her. She was cooking my one meal of a day. Okay, so that's important for me. If I miss that or she messes it up, that's, you know, a lot of problems. So she was cooking my one meal of the day and the doorbell rang. So I said, not out of compassion for my mother, out of selfishness, I'll make sure I get a good meal. I will answer that, Mum. Don't you mess up the cooking. So I went to answer the door, and on the other side of the door, this was in London, was what they called a gypsy woman, trying to sell things, you know, cheap things. And, you know, it's just like door-to-door salesman, you know, and it was just rubbish stuff. So I quite politely said, "No, thank you." And this gypsy woman, then she started her marketing pitch. And it was well-known, you probably know that before, Chanda, and anyone else in England. They said, "If you don't buy this trinket from me, I will put a gypsy curse on you." That's what she said. And I wasn't going to take any of that. I just stood up straight and said, "Look at this. I am a Buddhist monk. My curses are much stronger than yours." That's what I said. You should have seen this woman's face. She went so scared, because I'm a Buddhist monk wearing these robes. She recognized that and she ran away. She couldn't get out fast enough. She never came back. Of course, I don't have any curses. If I did, I wouldn't do any curses on anybody. You know, that's not what a monk does, but she didn't know that. So if anyone does the evil eye on me, I do it back again. My curses are bigger than yours. And they really get scared. So no, they try that. They can't do that. And same as you, they can't do that on you. You know, you're good people. You don't realize the power you have. That happened to me, actually, just in the first year when staying in Magnolia Street, we were going on arms round, And this guy, he was actually painting one of the shops, and he stopped. And he looked at me and he said, "Who the hell are you?" I said, "I'm a Buddhist monk." And he said, "You don't realize what power you have." I asked, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm a witch." You meet some interesting people in Perth. But I was with another monk, and he said, "That monk is in trouble," and he was about to disrobe. He got it right, first up. So be careful. I've got more powers than witches. And you do. I don't realize that. So they can't do an evil eye on you. And that you can be jinxed in life and have everything going wrong and you jinx whoever you come into contact with. Absolutely not. You can't jinx me. I challenge you. Jinx Ajahn Brahm. Jinx means like put a spell or something. You know, give me bad luck. I understand that restlessness is rooted in aversion. So for an anagami who has overcome craving and aversion, how does restlessness still arise? Is it only the cruder form of anger, lust that have vanished for an anagami? Will subtler manifestations such as irritation preferences be rooted out too? Also, if anagamis and arahats have overcome sloth and torpor, do they still need to sleep and why? Wouldn't the mind, if not the brain, always be awake? Many thanks. Okay, now this is about a non-returner. So you get close, become a stream winner at least first of all, and then you might understand the answer to that question. Because sometimes people haven't got a clue what a non-returner is. So a non-returner, yes, they do have a last tiny bit of restlessness, you know, when they're not in jhanas. You know, they still sometimes think, they do things. But it is far, far less than any of you. So it's this tiny bit, the tiny little vestige. It's just like, you know, when they, this is actually how they talked about it. It's just like when you've washed your clothes. And, you know, after it comes out of the dryer, you've still got a bit of a smell of the detergent. But, you know, you put it on the line, and after an hour or two, you know, the air just takes away the last smell of the detergent. So this is the last scent, you know, of the restlessness is still lingering there, but only slightly. It's like, and I haven't been back in my cave yet, but many of you have been in that cave, and you know, sometimes when you go in the cave, I know you've been in there. You know, you leave that last lingering bit of you, and it's not me. Even though you've gone, there's still the scent, the vibes, whatever it was, and I know you've been in there. So, but that's why I'm letting you go. I haven't been in for days, so you know, as soon as you've gone, I've got to get all those vibes out. I'm just being, well, yeah. So there is that lingering bit of restlessness now. That's all there is there. And sloth and torpor, they don't have sloth and torpor, but they still have to rest. That's a physical thing they have to do. Dear Ajahn, can a person who lives in austere living conditions achieve enlightenment, or is the middle way an absolute necessity, and will there be caves built for retreat participants in the future, so you don't have to keep going in mine? Your room is a cave. You know, you can just put down these shutters, close them, and it's perfectly dark. So every one of you has a cave. A cave with an electric light bulb, an ensuite, and a nice mattress. What better cave can you get? So it's just when you close out all of the sound, close out all of the light, you know, be inside, that's called a cave. So you've got in a cave already. And austere living conditions. Austere, as long as it is healthy. It can be simple, but healthy, and that's just the right level. But when we say ascetic, in other words, you start getting sick. You know, you're sitting down, you're not eating, and just you start getting thinner and thinner and thinner. And, you know, you get this thickness and that thickness. That's going too far. The Ajahn, for how long can I milk an act of good karma for? Is it like a tea bag, only good for one use or two uses at the most? When I my first year in Thailand, tea bags were so rare, I would use them three times. Absolutely true. The first time I would use them, and I'd get a really good cup of tea. The second, I would dry them out. I would make sure that nothing dripped out. Dry it out, and I'd use it again. The third time, I'd boil it. And I get three cups of tea out of every tea bag in the good old days. These days, you namby-pamby cream puffs. You have so many tea bags, you throw them all away. But that's absolutely true. But good act of karma, you can milk that forever. You can also milk bad karma forever, can't you? You know, what someone, you did something wrong. And you're still torturing yourself time and time and time and time again. Every time you remember it, you torture yourself again. It's absolutely crazy stuff. You know, you did something wrong. Or even worse, someone did something wrong to you. You know, they cheated on you or something. And they maybe cheated you 4 or 5 years ago. Every time you remember that, you're allowing them to hurt you again. You didn't do any wrong karma. They did the bad karma, but you're the one suffering. That's absolutely ridiculous. So if someone did something wrong and hurt me, they hurt me once, that's all. And I forget about it. I let it go. I will not allow people to keep on hurting me like that. So I don't even remember it. I don't keep the pain of the past. But the problem is you keep on milking the bad karma again and again and again. You get so upset, so guilty, so angry. And the good karma you don't milk enough. You did this beautiful act. You opened the door for Ajahn Brahm as he left the hall. Have you forgotten it already? Remember it. You opened the door of your heart to a monk. You know, you gave him a cup of tea with biscuits, with condensed milk. Oh, what wonderful joy that was. Remember that forever and ever and ever and ever. You can milk that because condensed milk is very thick. You can milk that for a long time. It's actually not condensed milk. I call it samadhi milk. You know, concentrated milk. So it's samadhi milk for people. So you can milk it a lot, which is very good. My goodness. Okay. Can you please explain the idea of a sotapanna? Nah. We'll go through this quickly. We've only got a few turns to go. Do you want me to do it, sotapanna? Sotapanna is someone who's seen non-self. They realize there's nobody in here. Absolutely, 100%. They never think there's a me or a mine. A Buddha is enlightened. Arahat is also enlightened. What is the difference between the two? One begins with a B, the other one begins with an A. The Buddha was the first of the Arahats Buddha cycle. By throwing away past baggage and stopping dreams of future, one is to be mindful and aware of the present moment for meditation. After this retreat is over, we shall be back home or to workplaces. How do you know you have taken up the future? Throw away the future and don't even think of going home. This is home. Wherever you are, that is your home. Why are you always going somewhere instead of being here? I remember seeing sort of in these magazines people who've arrived. You know, Andrew Forrest, most wealthy person in Australia, he's arrived. Angelina Jolie, famous, beautiful, she's arrived. Ajahn Brahm, he's always here. I'm always arrived. Where am I supposed to be going? Have you arrived yet? Or are you still trying to get to the place you're supposed to arrive to, wherever that happens to be? Be one who has arrived. I'm here, and I'm staying here. I'm not going anywhere. The past is coming to me, but I'm not going chasing it. You know, that's what happens to me. You know, people say, why are you travelling around so much, Ajahn Brahm? Next week I'll be in Melbourne and then Vietnam and then Korea in May. I don't travel anywhere. I have the same experience as you have. I sit on the aircraft. I don't move. The aircraft moves. I look out the window. The sky is moving. I'm not moving. I'm perfectly still. I never move anywhere. Life moves around me. Time comes, time goes, but wherever the time goes, I'm always here. You know, I was here just when this retreat began. I'm here now. Nothing's much changed. You people haven't changed. The same people, the same stories, the same jokes. Nothing changes, does it? What is the future anyway? Is the future real? Or is it just an imagination? What is the only thing which is real is right now. Don't be deluded by the imaginary future. You've arrived. You're here. Enjoy it. Stop going places. After this retreat is over and we should be back home or workplaces, should we not keep the memory of noble silence present? The moment awareness. Yeah, keep noble silence. You may be sort of like a radio presenter. And just keep noble silence. For my program today as a radio presenter, I'm not going to speak. Some of you may, wouldn't it be wonderful actually if politicians practiced noble silence? Imagine that in parliaments all around the world. They had noble silence days. Very interesting, wouldn't it? Anyway, at least, you know, sometimes people say about free speech. Do you believe in free speech? I don't believe in free speech. I think all speech should be taxed. It shouldn't be free. And the more you speak, the more you have to pay. That would actually keep life much quieter. So in your house, you have a meter on your wife's mouth. And if she speaks a lot, she has to put a lot in the kitty. And if you speak a lot, you have to pay a lot. And the ones who speak the most, they're the ones who create the most trouble. They're the ones that, obviously monks accepted, like me. But everyone else. So I don't believe in free speech. Speech should be taxed, because it causes too much trouble. And the ones who speak the most should pay the most. And that way we wouldn't have to pay tax on anything else. And you know the people who pay the most tax will be the politicians. Because, you know, they decide, you know, what to buy. So they should pay the most. So there should be no more free speech. Speech may be a dollar a word. And then you'd shut up. You couldn't afford to argue with your wife. You know, if we did that once, here we go, again, there's more stories. When we went to India on pilgrimage, I think we still do this. We did that last time, the complaints box.
No, they were threatened to.
He didn't do it, he should do it. We had, when I went on pilgrimage, because, you know, you're going on pilgrimage to India and the road is rough and people get diarrhea, the food is not nice or something. People always complain. So we said, okay, we put a box in the front of the bus, complaints box. Every complaint, $10. I know, was it 10 rupees or something? I forget what, but say $10. And then all the money in the box, you know, would go to, you know, one of the charities somewhere, like a hospital or somewhere in India. So if you complain, $10 in the box. And this guy came in and said, I put 50 in, I'm getting 5 in advance. Because he knew he was always complaining. But at least it stopped a lot of people complaining. We had to pay for it. Should we do that, Bianca, at the end of this retreat, have a complaints box? So if you want to complain to Bianca, $5. Is that too much? Okay, we'll give you 3 for $10. $10. Should we not keep the memory of noble silence, present moment awareness, insight, meditation, etc., relating to this meditation outside past baggage for meaningful life in the future? As to say, at least for a few moments meditation daily at places where we live. Yeah, you'll meditate in the future. You don't have any choice because you've been brainwashed. So whether you like it or not, you'll remember this. Can you talk sometimes about the Nalanda University during its heydays and what caused its decline? Okay, that was a university just outside of India, and it was one of the best universities. And this was like so early, way before Oxford and Cambridge. You know, this was a long time ago. And actually, do you know how Harvard University started? Because I went to Cambridge, and my college, Emmanuel College, that's where John Harvard studied. And, you know, they keep on sending me these alumni books every now and again. And they had one of the old members of Emmanuel in Cambridge. He became the Bishop of Southwark. And that's where the Harvard family lived. He did some research and he found out the dirt on Harvard University. This is the dirt on Harvard. That John Harvard, he went up to Cambridge. He was a Puritan. you know, into not sort of, no vices, nothing. No doubt the Puritans in that time, but his family, where he came from, they were totally opposite. Southwark is just over the river in the southern part of London. Now, the northern part of London was actually governed by the Diocese of Westminster. Basically, the bishops there had full power, you know, especially on people's morals. So in the north of the River Thames, you couldn't do anything. No alcohol, no sex, no vices, nothing. Because the Bishop of Westminster stopped everything. South of the river, it was governed by the Bishop of Winchester, which is about 100 miles away. So south of the river, anything goes. So, you know, that was the King's Cross, the North Bridge, the Patpong Road of London. You know, the south of the river. And that's where John Harvard's family were. So John Harvard's father, he had a pub, very well known. Please excuse me, a brothel. He had a butcher's shop. And he also had like a gambling den. And that's where the family made all the money. You know, you get a lot of money out of vice. People who run those clubs. And that was John Harvard's family. And so John Harvard was up in Cambridge. His family were making fortune in the south of the river because of, you know, the bishop was too far away to stop things. And that's when the plague came. And his whole family were wiped out. And John Harvard inherited all the money. And obviously sold everything up and took the money and started Harvard University on the wages of sin. That's where and that's actually absolutely 100% true story. And when I told that to some of these alumni from Harvard, we had this big thing once in Bangkok, Harvard and Cambridge University in Oxford, we had this alumni club and I gave a talk there. They were stunned. They never heard that before. Of course you won't hear. They won't tell you that, but that's absolutely true. So now you know where Harvard came from. From prostitution, gambling, and beer. So, Nalanda University, probably the same. I don't know. But anyway, got wiped out by the Muslims, you know, who came there. And they thought it was a fort. They thought the monks were soldiers. And they killed them all before they asked what they were. And they just wiped it all out. And that's in their records. Anyway, I've had depression on and off for years. You come here, you won't have depression, all these stupid stories. You'll laugh your head off and the depression will be gone. Sometimes I feel really hopeless and want to take my own life. What tools can I use these times to help me be hopeful? Get an Ajahn Brahm talk. You know, actually, I don't know what actually happened to it. We did actually start getting an Ajahn Brahm joke book. You know all the jokes and the funny stories I tell here? And I said to collect them from all the talks which I give, and just take the jokes, nothing else, not the nice stories, not the important, just the jokes, and actually put them in a book. A person in Hong Kong was doing that. I'm not quite sure where it went to. And you know what the title was called? Hahayana. Collected jokes from Ajahn Brahm. So hopefully that'll be printed in Hong Kong soon. I forget where it's got to, but then actually you can take out a Hahayana book and you start laughing at these things. Because laughter is a wonderful way to overcome depression. You can't laugh and be depressed at the same time. And if that doesn't work, can you just go and just stand in the mirror? 20 push-ups in front of the mirror. I think I told you that already. If you're depressed and upset, go in the bathroom, stand in front of the mirror, hand up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, until you burst out laughing. You just can't stand it. You've got to laugh. You stupid face you're making. That overcomes depression. And lastly, perhaps one of the most powerful ways of overcoming depression is go and do some community service. Come to a place like Jada Grove, do some gardening, or help Danny do some cleaning or something like you see people do. You know, I don't know, maybe your temple, an old people's home, a hospital or something. You go and do some social service and you'll find depression vanishes. Because you're giving yourself some meaning in life. And my goodness, there's a lot of places need help. So that is a brilliant way of overcoming depression. Get out there and help somebody. Dear Ajahn, thanks for your metta. Let's talk about the art of listening, okay? Do you reckon listening is far more important than talking? As a teacher, speaker, why? Because if everyone was talking, no one would listen to my amazing speeches. So I thank you very much, because you know, imagine that you never turned up. Would have been much point talking? Actually, I remember this one monk that actually did that. He couldn't stop speaking. Absolutely true. He used to give his talk for 4 hours. This monk. Actually, he came to visit here some years ago. And the monks in Wat Pa Phong were so upset at him that first of all they turned off the PA system and he carried on talking. They turned off all the lights. He carried on talking. Everybody left. That never stopped him. He was amazing. That's Ajahn Subin. Oh, an incredible monk. He was famous for that. The hall was empty, but he'd carry on giving his Dhamma talk till he was finished. He was a legend for that. Why not? You know, who needs people to listen? You're giving a Dhamma talk. So it is important to listen. But I gave a talk a couple of weeks ago at Nolamara Center. You know, we've got right speech. That's the third factor of the Eightfold Path. I also said right listening. That's not in the Eightfold Path, but that's really important. You can have right speech. Have you ever noticed you say the right things and really beautiful things, but people totally misunderstand you? They're not listening with kindness. They're listening with ill will, waiting for you to say something wrong. This is the trouble. I mean, you guys are okay. Sometimes I give talks at universities and they're waiting for me to make a mistake. And they do this. They say, Ajahn Brahm, in your talk last week, you said this, and now you've just said that. Get out of that. And they're always like fault-finding when they're listening, trying to pick faults in what you're saying, or trying to pick out sort of errors in your logic, inconsistencies in what you're saying. That is not right listening. That's listening with a fault-finding mind. Or somebody, your enemy, comes up to you and say, look, I'm sorry what I did to you. And you think, they're up to some mischief. I know they are. They're not really sorry. That is wrong listening. Right listening is with compassion, giving people the benefit of the doubt. Somebody says something which offends you. Right listening is give them the benefit of the doubt. They probably didn't mean that. They just made a mistake or you heard it wrong. Right listening is with compassion, forgiveness, not fault finding. And it's wonderful to be able to talk about right listening because not many people mention that. When you're with your wife, right listening is nothing, oh, here she goes again. How long do I have to... She goes on and on, always the same stuff. Blah, 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 blah. That's not right listening, is it? That's wrong listening. Same with your husband. I'm too tired, darling. Shut up. That's wrong listening. Just listen with kindness, with respect. That's right listening. So, we reckon listening is more important than talking. As a teacher, speaker, why? In the Western countries such as Australia, people talk more than listen, no matter one is an Asian or white Australian. Normally everyone keeps talking, but no one is listening. And stand firm with their own point of view. But the sutta says, do not trust one's own views unless one gets to the state of an arahat. This is true. Yeah, just keep doubting your views and understandings. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt as well. You know, it's okay to be wrong. So assume you're wrong. Remember that old story about the husband and wife, the chicken and the duck? No, that's in the book. Do you want to... No, I'm not going to tell that whole story, but just in brief, something went quack quack. The wife said it was a chicken. The husband said it's a duck. No, it's a chicken. No, it's a duck. It's a chicken. It's a duck. Quack quack. See, it's a chicken. And the husband said, I think you're right, darling. It is a chicken. Quack quack. Which meant they were in peace and harmony together. Who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? Is that really important? Sometimes people think being right is so important, you will argue over a chicken or a duck. And that is a problem with marriages. We argue over the stupid stuff. So in that verse in the story, the full story is in opening the door of your heart. And the full story is that the husband said, oh, I think you're right, it is a chicken. And she said, thank you, darling. It went quack, quack again. And that means he had a dinner that evening. They didn't have an argument. And they saw in the newspaper that was a chicken, which went quack quack because it came from Japan, from Fukushima nuclear plant. And it could be. Just because it's a chicken, it doesn't always go cock-a-doodle-doo. There are some chickens which go quack quack. Mutant chickens. Four more questions, I'll do this quickly. Programming the mind worked for me. Before, when Nimitta appeared, I used to have fear or doubt, then I told myself not to be afraid. Unfortunate, the tranquility gone. Today, after silent present moment, I said three times, I will be still and embrace it. This is an imitator. I watched the breath in and out for some time and I saw a space. After a while I saw bright little spots and it lasted a few seconds. I was still calm and back to breath. The next ones were brighter and lasted a bit longer, maybe 5 to 10 seconds. I felt so good. After staying for a while, nothing happened. I'm out of meditation. It was about an hour session. Thanks. You're getting there. Because this is the programming mindfulness. Any problem in the meditation, if you're getting into the deep meditation, you get these lights coming up and you give instructions, you disturb everything. Now that's just like the simile of the still forest pool. Whenever you say something, the animals know that you are looking at them and they'll run away, they won't come back again. So the way to deal with the problems, or the nimitta problems, you give the instructions early on in the meditation, like this lady did. I will be still and embrace the nimitta. So you say that at the very beginning, three times, very clear, very simple, in your own words. When the nimitta comes up, you don't get afraid, you don't do anything, you're still, you embrace things. Well done. How do you stay still and quiet inside no matter what is happening? Because nothing is happening. It's just you're still and quiet inside. It's inside is most important. What goes on out there is somebody else's business. So this is why another thing, which I do, my other mantra. If you want another mantra, I've done shut up, done good enough. The other one is called none of my business. So I'm sitting here and there's a noise, none of my business. Someone comes in, none of my business. A thought comes up in my head, none of my business. An ache in my leg, none of my business. An imitta comes up, none of my business. That's my other mantra, which I love using. None of my business. It's none of my business, I don't do anything. Not my business. I'm not going to do anything. So I like the none of my business. This afternoon I totally let go during my meditation. I felt very peaceful, calm and happy. And then I fall asleep. Help. Why is it I'm back to sleepiness again? Is this what's supposed to happen when you let go? You didn't have enough happiness and joy. So when you let go beautifully. Oh, yes, yeah, it's really nice. Really get into it. Oh, yeah, take more of this. Wow. Start indulging in letting go. And then it's so happy you can't fall asleep. Remember once I remember telling you about going up into the jungles in Guatemala. And part of that trip I had to go to the east coast of Guatemala and take a fishing boat up the coast and then up the river. And it was at dawn. And I hadn't slept all night. And I remember seeing the dawn come up over the Caribbean. And it was amazing. It was such a beautiful experience. Even though I just really wanted to fall asleep, I just couldn't. It was just too beautiful to go to sleep. I remember that experience. You know, beautiful dawn over the Caribbean. You know, 1969 from a fishing boat. You know, really, really tired. But I couldn't let myself go to sleep. It was too enjoyable. If your meditation is like that, you won't go to sleep. How many of you guys are going to watch the World Cup soccer? It's coming up soon, isn't it? In July in Brazil. You know, these guys, they 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. They start to watch the soccer. Get them to meditate to 10 o'clock. No way. Dear Ajahn, last question. Where and how did you learn the Pali language? Is there a correspondence course in Pali language? I learnt it myself. Taught myself. And then I taught Ajahn Brahmani. He's teaching other people just this afternoon when I went to Bodhinyana. They were teaching Pali again. So you can teach yourself Pali. It's very easy. Remember the first word I taught you in Pali? Remember that word? Gomayang? So now you know some Pali anyway. You've got a bone here. This is interesting. I've got a bone question. Someone's got a bone to pick with me or something. At Sirivat Hospital, wasn't there a ghostly incident in a lift? Woo. See over bone, over teeth. This is, I don't know where the bone comes from. Is it a real bone? Okay. Well, many of you know this ghost story. Do you want to turn the lights down again? Yeah, go on. This is a ghost story which is going to keep you awake tonight. This is a true one. It's not a joke one like the coffin story. Wow. Now this is scary. This is absolutely true. This is ghosts in hospitals. In hospitals there are many ghosts. I was talking to, or was it Dr. Woon, over in JB, Johor Bahru. And this, he works in the old British hospital in Johor Bahru. The Singaporeans built when British were in Singapore, they built the hospital over the other side of the causeway in Johor. And it's such an old hospital, there's lots of ghosts there. He was saying he was doing an operation. He was doing an operation in the old operating theatre. And he asked the nurse for some scalpel or something, and the nurse gave it to him, and then he noticed the nurse was over there. No one was behind him. The nurse helped him with the operation, the ghost rather. No one behind him at all. And he just automatically, passed me the tweezers or something, and someone gave him the tweezers, and then he realized it was a ghost just gave him the tweezers. Happens a lot in those hospitals. Now this hospital is much worse. It was in Sirivat Hospital, the main hospital. That's actually where I used to go to the autopsies, where I saw the head on the plate. Sirivat Hospital, the main hospital in Bangkok. A doctor just finished the night shift. He was in the elevator, this huge hospital, in the elevator, going down to the car park at the basement to go home. He was with a nurse at the time. And the elevator stopped, they're halfway down. The doors opened. There was a patient outside, with the patient said, obviously a patient. And the doctor froze in horror. And without saying anything, he quickly pressed, to close the elevator door button until the elevator doors closed before the patient could get in. And the nurse was really upset. What are you doing that for? A patient wants to get into the lift. And the doctor, stammering through fear, he said, that was one of my patients who died last night. I saw it dead. That's a dead man. That's a ghost trying to get into the lift. And now in Thailand, when somebody dies, I don't know if they still do it, but in the old days, they tie a red string around their wrist, to prove to everybody that, that was a dead person. And so the doctor said to the nurse, didn't you see? He's got the red string around his wrist. And at that point, the nurse raised her hand and said, I've got a red string too. Does that mean I can't go in the lift as well? He had a ghost inside and one outside. And that's a true story, because that's exactly what he said when they revived him. They found him unconscious on the floor of the lift. And when they revived him, he was in the hospital, so it's easy to revive him. And that's the story he told. And of course, he proved that that patient had died. And that nurse, she had died on the way to the hospital in a car accident. Even though she died, she went to work. And the poor doctor had one ghost inside and one outside, no escape. And it's amazing that when you're in the lift, you just don't know whether the person sitting next to you is a ghost or not. But please, have a look at their wrist. See if they have a red string. Okay, good night everybody. Sadhu! 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 Okay, I should make the announcement. Tomorrow night is a special night. because I have to go to Nolamara city center to give the Friday evening talk. You know, there's many thousands of people listen to that live on the internet, as you probably have done before. So I will not be here to answer your questions tomorrow night. Instead, we have these three Sangha members who have been freeloading all week. Not really freeloading. But you can actually ask these three, Venerable Bodhidharma, Venerable Chand, and Venerable Anya, the questions tomorrow night. So you can ask them specifically, what's it like being a Buddhist nun? This monk is from Switzerland. Now, what's it like, you know, being a Buddhist monk? Why did you come from Switzerland? All the way to Perth. Ask them some nice, interesting questions. And that will be in the box for tomorrow night, to either of these three. And you can actually put the question in. This is to the monk. This is to Chanda. That's Chanda there. This is to Anya. You can write it down to each one and see what they say. It's good fun. Keep it fun.
Can't we keep noble silence?
No noble silence from you guys. No, you have to stay here. So you can ask them any of their ghost stories they've had in their life, interesting stories, why they became nuns, why they became monks, and especially this one over here on Sunday, she's becoming a bhikkhuni. Isn't that wonderful? Yes! Woohoo! Am I dobbing you in? Okay, but that's tomorrow night. So nice questions for these three. Funny questions, naughty questions, any questions are okay.